Hi, my name is Dennis. I'm an alcoholic.
Yes.
I really feel privileged, and thank you for allowing me to share my experience, strength, and hope with you. You get to speak a lot of times in groups where no one knows you, which is kind of nice, and then speak in places where a lot of people know you, which is special. So I just wanted to start off by rereading something very familiar to us. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. So I'm sitting in this lawyer's office and looking around. I'm in the waiting room and I can see him at his desk on the phone. And, I really don't want to be there because I'm in a lot of trouble. So he's talking and I'm waiting. He's talking and I'm waiting. And finally, I kind of look in and he gives me one of these. He's still talking on the phone, but he's got his glasses on and he's reading something, which was my file. Now, just to give you a little visual, he had on this really expensive dark pinstripe suit. He was a chubby, red-faced Italian guy with thick black hair and this white starched collar that looked like it was cutting up into his neck, right? So he's reading it, and he looked up at me with his glasses on, and he got off the phone, and he kept reading. And the first thing he said to me was, "They're cracking down on guys like you right now." And I said, "It figures. It just figures, right?" That is my story. It figures. What he was reading was that this was my third DUI. It was September 1988, and they were cracking down. They were cracking down on guys like me. MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, was very big, and the DA was specifically, out to clean up the roads of Long Island. The second DWI had only been about a year earlier. I had been on probation for like forever, it seemed. I think I might have gotten off of it once and found myself, back in that whole program again. So the second DUI, I kind of managed through this DUI school and some high-level counseling and some meetings that I had to go to. But I just remember going to that because it was a checkbox, not really feeling involved. Matter of fact, I remember, at one of these alcohol group sessions, doing drugs in the bathroom. So obviously I was not very committed to it. The first DUI, I remember my boss saying, "Hey, you know what? Anybody could get a DUI. It can happen to anybody. Second one, you got bad luck. Third one, you got a problem." And I'd always remembered that, right? And and I would say, "Well, I've just got bad luck right now," or, "Ooh, I got really bad luck now." But when the third one hit, it was, I knew the jig was up. There were tickets on this rap sheet. There was a one-car accident where I tried to climb a telephone pole with my Grand Prix. Doesn't work very well, the telephone pole one. And more severely, this third DUI was a head-on collision with a van. In a nutshell, I was a drinker and a driver. I had no problem, and there was never any thought in my mind, there was never any guilt about however much I was drinking, I got to go. I got to get in the car, and I got to go, wherever that was. It usually was something like Jack in the Box at 3 o'clock in the morning. Painful experience, Jack in a Box. But that's what I did. I mean, and you know, what he didn't see was the thousands of times that I drank when I shouldn't have been on the road. You know, situations where, you know, I remember one night trying to run a guy who cut me off, run him off the road. I mean, it was like a scene out of Mad Max, you know, with the bumpers on the front of the car. I literally tried to run this guy off the road. You know, I had grown up in Long Island, and I'm, you know, here I am, I'm 20 something years old, and you know, I'm getting lost on roads that I had been on so many times in my life. You know, just driving and then saying, you know, 30 miles later, holy smokes, I'm going in the wrong direction. You know, so but again, never thinking. That actually, I was one of the guys that thought I was a good driver when I was drinking. You know, how many people have said that? Yeah. My driving actually gets better. Yeah. You know, when I drink. So, you know, and it this was all happening. You know, in 6 short years in probation with the driving thing. But it goes back much further than that. out of high school, which I went to a Catholic high school, I went to a Catholic grammar school, I was going to go to college and had no motivation to go to college. I was looking out the window one morning while I was taking a shower, and I said, and I saw this plane flying by, and I said, you know, I'd really like to become a pilot. What better place to learn how to fly than the Air Force? So 3 weeks later, I found myself in Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas, with a shaved head and green clothes for the next 4 years. Which, you know, it was a good experience for me. You know, it had a lot of discipline. You're living in a barracks. There's something to say for that, you know, living in a pack life. If you've ever lived in a group like that, it's pretty interesting dynamic. You know, I did a lot of things. I went to Korea for a year. I spent a couple of years in Michigan, Texas. I know I don't really like Texas that much after that, but it, you know, I felt like it gave me a sense of responsibility. But boy, did we drink a lot. I know this for a fact. I was in Korea for 365 days. Every day except for 4 did not drink. And why I know that it was only 4 days I didn't drink, I don't know. But I remember it was 4 days. And it was probably due to not having the cash, you know, to buy it. But usually somebody was always willing to cover you until next payday. While I was in Michigan, I got called into my squadron commander's office. That was never a good thing. All right, the less you saw him, the better off you would be. And, you know, right around this time, I lived in the barracks, and a lot of the guys that I knew were getting busted for one thing or another. And, you know, my paranoid kind of set in. And I probably made myself sick for like 2 days thinking about it. I had to get dressed up in my Class A, Class 1 uniform and report into him. And he started reading something. And I was an airman, Airman Barry at the time. He said, you've been selected as a candidate for the Air Force Academy. I was shocked. You know, I was like, holy smokes. Yeah, I had never thought about that. And I said, well, when do I have to let you know? And he said, tomorrow morning. And it's about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon the day before. And I said, okay. So I went home, went back to the room that night. I probably got drunk. And went back in to see him the next morning and told him no thank you. this was the first, I'll call it, turning point in my life that I really became aware of. You know, when I thought about the reason why I went into the service, it was to be a pilot. And here was a perfect step to becoming a pilot, and I turned it down. You know, I was living amongst a bunch of guys that drank and did stuff just like I did. We talked about, you know, man, this really sucks. You know, I can't wait to get out. And, you know, it becomes somewhat of a feeding frenzy when you start thinking like that. And all I could think of was, you know, I'm not signing up for, you know, another 4 years and then another 6 years on top of that. So I respectfully declined. Now, today, I look back at that as a turning point in my life. I have no regret about the decision today because, you know, things work out the way they're supposed to. But I always look back at that to say how the decisions that we make at any given moment shape even the rest of our lives. I mean, that could have been a life-changing decision that would have, you know, not made a difference. I don't know. I'm not saying it made a difference, but it definitely would have been different. So, you know, I was just glad I wasn't getting busted, you know, for pot seeds or something found in my room. So, I started the whole service thing. I was starting to get into a little bit more, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. You know, I didn't have a good support group around me. The last thing I wanted to do was go back to my family and burden them with all this stuff. They got their own problems, you know. All they want to know is that I'm safe and staying out of trouble, which by some miracle I happened to do it 4 years. Now, came home on a vacation in my last year of enlistment, and my uncle and my father took me out for dinner to talk about my future. Now, I'm 22 at this point. Let's talk about your future. Okay, you know, they were both computer programmers. One worked for IBM, the other one worked for Citibank. And they're gonna work out this plan where you're gonna go to this school, this trade school, you're gonna learn some computer programming, and then we're gonna get you a job at one of the companies that me and your two uncles work for. Okay, sounds like a good plan. So, you know, 6 months later, I got out of the service, and I went to this trade school, did okay, you know, nothing special. Was working as a waiter in a catering hall on the weekends, which was a great job because, I mean, the beer and alcohol are just all over the place, and, you know, the customer's paying for it, so all you got to do is, you know, take out a six-pack or whatever, and the waiters were usually having a better time than the people that were there at the party. So, you know, I got it to, did okay, graduated from this trade school for computer programming, and my uncle who worked at IBM brings home this application for a job at IBM. You know, again, 22 years old, no real practical business experience, and I get this job application, and it's like 10 pages long. And there's 4 pages dedicated to filling out your patents. And I'm like, patents? What do they think they got here, you know? So, you know, I probably had half a page here and then a signature filled out on this thing. Needless to say, I didn't get a job at IBM. My father got me this interview with a guy who was the midnight shift computer operator guy. And the guy said to me, he goes, well, what do you really want to do? You know, he's a computer operator. And I go, I really want to be a computer programmer. I didn't get that job. And my father kind of went off the deep end. Why did you tell him you wanted to be a computer programmer? Like, well, Dad, I thought that's what we had all agreed to, you know. And he goes, you say whatever you think that guy wants to hear. And then my other uncle got me an interview, and that didn't work out. So for 2 years after I graduated from the school, I'm like jobless. I mean, not doing what I went to school for. I worked at Entenmann's. You all know Entenmann's, right? I shoveled the crumbs on top of the crumb cakes. That was actually a pretty good job. It always smelled good, you know, and the dogs were always sniffing me whenever I came home. I put together swing sets for catalogs, you know, odd jobs, and it was really, I went into this alcoholic phase of just, you know, not really having to get up in the morning, no real structure in my life, falling into bad habits, dealing with the rejection. The whole bottom drawer of my dresser was filled, all right? And we're talking about a drawer, pretty nice size, just filled with these rejection letters from all the resumes that I sent out. It was tough to deal with all of that, you know, and how did I deal with it? Just like a good, solid alcoholic would. So, and that didn't really help, right? I mean, you don't get really motivated, and you just kind of, I remember, you know, for a long, long time there, you know, smoking a joint around 10 o'clock in the morning and watching all in the Family, you know, and, you know, you don't really realize this, until you're out of work, just how many commercials there are for training programs to drive a truck or to do this. And it's like every other commercial is geared towards the guy who's not working, which was me. So I can't even watch TV anymore because all it does is make me think about the fact that I don't have a job. Well, eventually I kind of reset my expectations. I got a job not as a computer programmer, but in a company that had computers in it. It had a computer there. So I wore a jacket and a tie to work every day, and I went to lunch with the computer programmers. And when there was an opening, a year or so later, they said, "Hey, you want to be a programmer?" And I was like, "Yeah." So I got my first job, three and a half, 4 years after I graduated from school, and I felt really proud about that, you know. Now I felt like, you know, I was kind of moving ahead and put the whole service thing behind me, and now I'm gonna go about my career. Well, you know, I'm not going to get into drugs, but I just want you to know that it is a part of my story, and that this job that really took me, put their trust in me, I did some things there that I really wasn't proud of. I didn't steal their money, but I did drugs during lunch and during breaks, you know, and stayed messed up for long stretches of time while I was working there. So essentially, I was stealing money, right? My time was becoming useless and non-productive because now those habits of smoking a joint, watching All in the Family, I couldn't stop it once I got this job. And, I was able to cover it up for a little while. And this is where I got my first DUI. And this was the boss that told me, it could happen to anyone. About a year or two later, I got my second DWI, they call them DWI up there. It's DUI down here. I got my second one, and that's when I knew I had really bad luck. But you know what? People were starting to figure me out. I could pretty much put up the facade for a while, but it didn't last long. People could figure me out, you know, because I was out of control and, you know, was just doing dumb stuff. So I left that job, right? And I kind of rationalized that I got to move on. It's time for me to move on, get my next job, be a professional. And the second job turned out to be, you know, even more of a disaster, because not only did I drink, but everyone else that I worked with there, including my boss and my boss's boss, would go to this bar and bet on the horse races during the afternoon. Every single day during lunch, we would drink, and there would be five of us. My coworker, my boss, and my boss's boss. I mean, not just a large glass of beer. I mean, like, five large glasses of beer and two-hour lunches. Now, this was in New Hyde Park, and I lived, it was about 35 miles away out on Long Island. And if anybody knows that area, you know that's a hell of a trip to make every day. And, you know, a long lunch had turned into a very short afternoon of work, and then an early release for more drinking. And I left that bar, I don't know, it was about 10 o'clock at night, and was with a couple of friends, and I think I made a wrong turn, you know, just like didn't know where I was going again. She's delirious, and I made this wrong turn, and I'm driving kind of with the window open. It's 20 degrees out, and all of a sudden the red lights in the rearview mirror. Now you know what that feeling is. You know, everything up here just drops to the pit of your stomach, and you say, oh boy, this is it. Another turning point in my life, which brought me to the lawyer's office. So he says, I'm just going to be honest with you. I don't know what I could do for you here, but I don't know what anybody's going to be able to do for you. I'll represent you, but it's going to be tough, and there's going to be some things that you're going to have to do at a bare minimum so that the judge knows that you're serious about it. But the DA is coming down hard on guys like you. If he said that one more time, I was going to reach across and grab that fancy tie he had on. But you know what? He wasn't being judgmental of me. He sat there very matter-of-factly, you know, these were the facts and this is what you got to do. I didn't feel like I was being attacked or judged by this guy. I knew it was in my best interest. So somehow the fact that I was in the Air Force came out, and he goes, well, you know, you can get in rehab at the VA in Northport. And he goes, I strongly recommend that you get into a 30-day treatment program and start developing some of those habits and documents so that when we go in front of the judge, he can see that. I said, okay. Couple days later, now my license is gone again. You know, I'm in my 20s here. You know, the professional who was doing well now doesn't have a driver's license. You know, how am I going to get around? Still with this job in New Hyde Park, having to tell them I got to take off for a month. You know, that doesn't go over too well. So it's becoming increasingly difficult to hide the facts and the circumstances. I don't know what they all were talking about. I don't know what they all were told. You know, I told one person what I had to do and didn't really want to hear, you know, what was going on. It was the shame, remorse, and guilt. You know, I just didn't even want to see these people, because I was so ashamed of what I would be facing. You know, here I am going to go. I have to go to the VA for 30 days, and that's just the first stop. There's no telling what's going to happen after I get out of that. So I go to the VA. My girlfriend, who I had just met 4 months earlier, and I knew these days were numbered. There's no way she's gonna hang around, right? We were supposed to go to her brother's house down in Florida that weekend that I got pulled over, which was, what's the Memorial Day weekend in September? Or is it Labor Day? Labor Day. I can never remember. It was Labor Day. We were supposed to go down to Florida for Labor Day, and that thing got canceled because, you know, I was in jail. So she drives me to the VA, and, you know, the nurse Ratchet is sitting there, and she's listening to me, and she goes, "No, we don't have any room. We don't have any beds." And I go, I really need to get in here. And she said, "What are you willing to do to get in here?" And I said, "Anything." She said, "I'll be right back." I sat in this room, which was probably half the size of this room, and it was just a brick, couple of windows, brick walls, and there were some folding chairs like these around the outside, nothing in the middle. And I sat in there by myself for about a half an hour. Now, I was not a spiritual person. Religion was something that my father did as a deacon in the Catholic Church. That was his deal, not mine. And I just sat there and I said to these four walls, "All right, here I am. I don't know what to do. I'm yours." So without knowing it, right, my higher power on that day was concrete brick wall. That's what my higher power was. I talked to the building. I talked to the room. That represented where I was and where I had to be for the next 30 days. You know, I came to find out later that was, you know, my first realization that there was a power greater than me, but at that moment it was concrete bricks, which was a higher power greater than me. And she came back in, and I was in. I can't overstate just how important those 30 days were to the rest of my life. I mean, you still hear me in meetings talking about a situation of that rehab. I learned a lot of lessons. I learned about AA. I mean, it was a lot of knowledge, but there was a lot of self-awareness. It was a drying out period. You know, I didn't drink, and I was around other people with similar stories. But I remember one afternoon, it's a 30-day program. You get in there on a Monday or whatever, and the first weekend, you're not allowed to go home. The other guys are allowed to go home. The second, third, and fourth week guys are allowed to go home. The first week, you got to stay there. So it's me and like five other guys, and I'm sitting there in my slippers making one of those keychains, you know, with the loops. You know, like at summer recreation camp you used to make them. I think I still have it. And it was a nice day out. And if you've ever been to a VA facility, you know, they're World War I, World War II buildings. You know, they're dark and they're ugly and they're... So I look out the window, and on the front lawn of the building that I'm in, this big brown sign, a big military-looking sign, and in white letters it says, "Psychiatric Ward." I started laughing because I felt like crying. How the hell did I wind up here? I am the last person in my family that should be here. You know? Part of that blame everybody else thing. I am the last person that should be here. How the hell did I get here? It was unbelievable. I was having a surreal moment, recognizing that I was in a psychiatric ward. It was. You can call it whatever you want. Rehab. I was in the psychiatric ward of a military hospital. Okay. Again, I don't know what that did to me. Made me realize, I think, the severity of what was going on here. So, you know, I got out of there. We talked about higher power. And I remember the woman who was my primary counselor. I'll never forget her. You know, there's about four women in my life that I really credit with making me who I am today. And Walda Solomon was one of them. And I always get emotional when I think of her. She was this big, husky woman with gray, curly hair, and she was the most beautiful woman I've ever met. And I remember she asked me, "Do you believe in God?" And I said, "Of course I believe in God." She said, "Bullshit. You don't believe in God. You don't believe in God." Wow, you know, no one's ever really talked to me like this. "What do you mean I don't believe in God?" She goes, "You've never relied on God a single day in your life." And she was right. So, you know, a lot of things that happened in that rehab, I didn't come to really understand until much, much later, you know, much later in sobriety. So I got to my second week in the rehab, and now I can go home. And the reason why you're able to go home in rehab is so that you can connect with the AA community while you're out, so that when you do get out of the rehab, you've got a place to go and continue getting well. And I went to this meeting, and I had been to AA meetings before, but I'll tell you, you know, this was different now. I mean, I had been to AA meetings. I had been around AA meetings as opposed to being a member of AA. And I know what that feeling is like, and I know what it feels like to attend an AA meeting versus be in an AA meeting. And I met a few guys, and I saw one guy who looked friendly to me, and his name was Dennis too, and I asked him to be my sponsor, and he was my sponsor for the first 2 years. He got me walked through step 1, 2, and 3. I shared this the other day, matter of fact, that we stayed focused on step 1, 2, and 3 for almost 2 years. There was a lot to do there. I was kind of anxious to get going on the fourth step, and he would say, you know, "Not yet, not yet." And, you know, that was the way his sponsor did it for him. But it got to the point where I really felt like I needed to do my fourth step. And it was the right time. I got another sponsor. There were some things going on in his life that I think he was supportive of the decision, and I had gotten another sponsor, and we quickly got to 4, 5, and 6, and that was a big relief. At this point now, I jumped over a couple of things as I got into AA and through my steps. You know, I got out of the rehab, which was really, really great. I got into AA meetings, which was really good. I was making as many meetings as I could possibly make without a driver's license, because now we start the whole 2 years without a driver's license, which is just, it's horrible if you've ever experienced it. And if you haven't, count your blessings, because it's just really a nightmare. It did teach me how to reach out to others, ask for help, which was a problem that I typically had. But when you don't have a car and you got to get to a meeting, you know, you got to reach out to people and get there. So back to, you know, I don't know that I really met my lawyer again until it came time for sentencing, which was around February now. So I've been out of the rehab for a couple of weeks, and court date is coming up. So I put my little 1988 suit on, which was kind of some ugly color and some flashy tie and some uncomfortable shoes, and waiting in the Nassau County courthouse, and it just didn't take long, and he goes, "Come on." We both walked up in front of the judge, and the judge, you know, asked me, how do I plead? And I said, I plead guilty. And Rita's probably thinking what my timeline is, and it might be a little screwed up. Usually the sentencing is later after you plead guilty, but I just, for some reason, I just, maybe he said, you've pled guilty, and now we're here at the sentencing. And I'm standing there with the lawyer, and my girlfriend is like in the second row in the stands there. And he said, 30 days, county courthouse. You know, I mean, I knew it was coming, but still hearing it from the judge is just a shocking, no matter how much you've had a chance to prepare it, because it's real now. The bailiff came out. It's in the courthouse, still standing in front of the judge. The bailiff comes out with the handcuffs, boom, slaps them on me, and escorts me out the other door that I did not come in. I turn and I look at my girlfriend sitting in the second row, and her mouth is open this wide, just in awe, like, oh my God, a surreal moment for her. You know, she was not expecting this. This was not part of the deal. This was not part of the deal. I'll give you a ride to the rehab. I'll drop you off. Adios is what I was expecting. She's still around. You know, it's 30 days rehab, driving me to some meetings. You know, I've got aftercare. You know, I had 18 months of aftercare. I mean, this is a lot of administrative stuff you have to deal with when you have that many DUIs. And she just was like, oh my God. And I called her that night to ask her to bring me a pair of sneakers. So, you know, because I had these horrible shoes on, and, you know, on slick, frequently buffed floors, it's not a good thing. Here I was, you know, asking her again to help. I mean, I was helpless. I mean, she had to come bring me shoes, you know, get a pair of nice county-issued orange pajamas that you wear 24 hours a day. And my parents came to visit me. You know, that's, I mean, what's going on here? The wreckage of a couple of DUIs, you know, is... And I remember, you know, leading up to that point, saying to my sponsor, you know, every day, I'm going to jail. I'm going to jail. I know I'm going to jail. This sucks. I can't deal with this. And he would say, are you going to jail today? And I'm like, no. And he goes, well, don't worry about it today. One day at a time. One day at a time. That was the message over and over and over. One day at a time. One day at a time. And, you know, that got me through. But, you know, here I am now. I'm in jail. And people are coming to see me. And, you know, it's still kind of shameful. And I don't, you know, it was a mess. You know, still hadn't drank in a few months now. Matter of fact, I celebrated my six-month sobriety in jail. And celebrated with another guy. And I got out. And I just remember, I remember the day. It was a nice day, right? It was a nice day in March. And I just turned around and looked at that building and said, I am not coming back here. You know, this, see you, again, talking to the buildings. There's something going on with me and buildings. I'm talking to, I am never coming, I'm not coming back to you. I didn't. I haven't been back there. I haven't gotten arrested again. Got a couple, you know, speeding tickets. But I got into AA. The compulsion to drink was lifted. The only way, you know, the only way I could have made it through, because, you know, I have a weak will, and, you know, I just remember, you know, I am not going to drink today. I am not going to drink today. And by 11 o'clock, I'm already thinking about where I'm going to get to. How, where, lunch, what am I going to do? It's going to be this. I'm going to have, you know, frost on the outside. And I would. I know, you know, they say, Dennis, you've got no willpower. You need more willpower. That's what, you know, most people will tell you is the answer to curbing your drinking. But, you know, while there were times of mediocre success, my drinking career was really it was a nightmare, and there was nothing proud about it. There was nothing funny about it. There was nothing cute about it. People that knew me knew I had a problem. When they saw me drinking, they wanted to go the other way. I hurt a lot of people, and I did things that I am certainly not proud of. And I figured, you know, if I can get into this AA and, you know, get cleaned up a little bit and get myself back on track, that's a good thing. You know, and they told me, don't think about the rest of your life. You know, think about it one day at a time. So I kept coming back one day at a time. I got sponsors. I worked the steps, and I volunteered. You know, whatever it was, if it was cleaning, you know, it made me feel like, you know, I'm not above this. I'm not a big shot. You know, I need to you know, go get the rat trap with the dead rat in it. I'll do it because somebody's got to do it. And you know, I started to work with other alcoholics. I remember it was, you know, January 1st of my 90 days sober, and my sponsor said, I got a present for you. It's like, oh, good, you know, like presents. The present was, you're speaking at the New Year's Eve meeting at such and such. I was like, oh my God. So my first time I spoke was on New Year's Eve with 90 days sobriety. I can't imagine what it must have been like to hear that, but help me. And then, you know, I moved down to Atlanta. I really was kind of hoping to have spent more time talking about my sober life because, you know, I'm coming up on 21 years, and there really has been so many more things to say about sobriety than anything that might have happened while I was drinking. You know, coming from a person who didn't know what he wanted to do, what he wanted to be, and then getting sober, thinking, okay, things are getting better. And then, you know, at 5 years, looking back and saying, I never would have predicted this would have happened. My life has gotten so much better in such a short period of time. It was really, the promises were coming true, and beyond my wildest dreams was all I could think of. I never could have hoped for the quality of this program bringing into my life and the things that it had done for me. I started to see miracles happen, and this wasn't stuff that I was doing. This was stuff that this program and my higher power were doing. I stopped believing in coincidences a long time ago because there's just too many weird things that happen to say that this is a coincidence. There's something else going on here. And, you know, when I work with somebody new in the program, you know, working with the steps, but I also try to help them with that awareness that a miracle happens every single day. I just, you know, wanted to close out. You know, I started off telling you about a turning point in my life. But I truly believe that every moment of my life is a turning point. It's a potential turning point. And whether I take the turn or not, that potential is there every single day for no matter what's going on. You know, there's been some big decisions that I've had to make. There's been some, you know, there's been pain and suffering in my sober life. You know, they would say it doesn't get any easier, but it gets better. What does that mean? You know, to me, easier is better. But I, you know, I've come to understand that, you know, life continues to go on. I've been on a spiritual journey that, you know, I it started off, who am I? You know, what are the big answers to the big questions, you know, and you set off reading and looking at all these different things, and I after a long time of reading and coming to believe certain things, I truly believe that for this alcoholic, the answers have always been right here in front of me. You know, this program has it all. It has it all for us. There's nothing over in Tibet that I need. There's always wanted to do that, though. I always wanted to go up on a mountain with a Tibetan monk and just, like, meditate for 30 days. I ride my motorcycle instead. This program has given me a lot of gifts, and I am just so grateful. You know, Don Roberts, who his cup is in that cabinet over there, would say, you know, alcoholism, it's not a bloody nose. This deal is not a bloody nose. It's serious, and it takes the lives of a lot of people. And to know that there's this as a solution for, you know, active alcoholism, I am so grateful that that's, you know, what I have, you know, because it's treatable. And if the results can be, and I know, you know, I don't work the program to perfection. I know I can do so much better. And if this is the payback for what I've put into it, then this is really an amazing deal. So stay sober one day at a time. Thank you.